Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is FS Credit Opportunities Corporation v. Saba Capital Master Fund Limited, docket number 24345, decided June 11, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. The Investment Company Act comprehensively regulates investment companies and designates the Securities and Exchange Commission as its primary enforcer. The petitioners, which we will call the funds, manage closed-end mutual funds and are incorporated in Maryland, where a state law limits the voting rights of shareholders holding a disproportionate number of shares. In June of 2023, the respondents, a group of activist investors known collectively as SABA, sued the funds, alleging that their resolutions opting into that law violated the Act's requirement that every share of stock have equal voting rights, and invoking Section 47B of the Act, which provides that a court may not deny rescission of a violating contract at the instance of any party unless doing so would be consistent with equity and the Act's goals. The question presented was whether Section 47B of the Investment Company Act creates an implied private right of action. The court held Section 47B of the Investment Company Act does not impliedly empower private parties to sue for rescission of contracts that allegedly violate the Act. Congress, not the judiciary, decides who may enforce federal law, and 47B is a mandate directed to courts about how to exercise their remedial authority, rather than a provision that confers a right to sue on any class of persons. Justice Barrett delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh joined. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Jackson filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Sotomayor joined, and in which Justice Kagan joined as to Parts 1 and 2. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to eliminate these and hope that it does not impact your listening experience. The following is the opinion of the court in FS Credit Opportunities Corporation v. Saba Capital Master Fund.
Congress, not the judiciary, decides who may enforce the law. The Investment Company Act designates the Securities and Exchange Commission as its primary enforcer and expressly permits shareholders and issuers of securities to enforce two of its provisions. We must decide whether another provision of the Act impliedly empowers private parties to sue for rescission of any contract that allegedly violates the Act. The answer is no. The Investment Company Act, ICA, comprehensively regulates investment companies. Petitioners, whom we will call the funds, are investment companies that manage closed-end mutual funds. These funds are called closed because they contain a fixed number of shares issued at one time. After shares are issued, capital does not regularly flow into the funds when investors buy shares, nor does it flow out when they sell. Instead, shares trade on the open market, which determines their price. Even though the net asset value of the holdings may be lower due to market fluctuations, long-term investors, like individuals saving for retirement, often favor closed-end funds. Respondents, Saba Capital Master Fund and Saba Capital Management, whom we will call Saba, manage open-end mutual funds. Unlike their closed-end counterparts, open-end funds continually issue new shares to investors. These funds do not trade on the market, and their shares are priced daily based on the net asset value of the underlying holdings. Because capital continually flows into and out of these funds as trading occurs, they are highly liquid. Sava's investment strategy includes identifying low-performing closed-end funds and purchasing a large enough stake to change the fund's behavior. Known as activist investing, this practice allows Sava to alter closed-end funds' investment strategies to make short-term profit or to convert them into open-end funds. To avoid activist investor takeovers, closed-end funds generally incorporate in jurisdictions with laws that favor them. The funds are incorporated in Maryland, which has enacted the Maryland Control Share Acquisition Act, MCSAA. The MCSAA limits voting rights for shareholders holding a disproportionate number of shares, like activist investors, unless other shareholders approve. In this way, it prevents rapid shifts in fund control. The funds have adopted resolutions opting into the MCSAA. In June 2023, Sava sued the funds over those resolutions. Sava alleged that they violate the ICA's requirement that every share of stock shall be a voting stock and have equal voting rights with every other outstanding stock. For a right of action, Sava invoked Section 47B of the ICA. That section provides that a court may not deny rescission of contracts that violate the ICA at the instance of any party unless the court finds that doing so would be consistent with equity and the ICA's goals. The District Court, following the Second Circuit's decision in Oxford University Bank v. Lanza B. Feeder decided in 2019, held that Section 47B creates an implied private right of action to sue for contract rescission and granted Sava summary judgment. The Second Circuit summarily affirmed, "We granted certiorari to resolve a circuit split over whether Section 47B contains an implied private right of action. Congress determines who may sue to enforce federal law. When Congress creates a private right of action, it usually does so expressly. For example, a person whose religious exercise has been burdened in violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act may assert that violation as a claim or defense in a judicial proceeding. A person aggrieved by discrimination may institute a civil action for preventative relief," and so on. Private litigants sometimes sue to enforce statutes that lack comparable language. At one point in time, the court stood ready to let them. It reasoned that courts should be alert to provide such remedies as are necessary to make effective the congressional purpose underlying a statute. But we have since rejected the practice of fashioning rights of action as we see fit. Homegrown causes of action are difficult to reconcile with the Constitution's separation of legislative and judicial power. Rather than augmenting statutes, we interpret them. If a statute does not spell out a right of action, we examine the statute's text and structure to determine whether it implicitly provides one. To create a private right, a statute must use rights-creating language aimed at protecting a particular class of persons. Gonzaga University v. Doe, decided in 2002, holds statutes create private rights when they are phrased in terms of the persons benefited. Language that focuses on the person regulated rather than the individuals protected does not fit the bill. And language establishing an express remedial scheme elsewhere in the statute may foreclose a private cause of action to enforce even those statutes that admittedly create substantive private rights. See Middlesex County Sewerage Authority v. National Sea Clamors Association, decided in 1981, holding existence of elaborate enforcement provisions forecloses the implication of additional judicial remedies. So we also examine whether Congress has provided other mechanisms for enforcing the provision at issue. With this framework in mind, we turn to the ICA. Section 47, entitled Validity of Contracts, contains two parts. The first provides that any contractual waiver of compliance with the ICA shall be void. The second provides that contracts made in violation of the ICA are unenforceable by either party unless a court finds that under the circumstances, enforcement would produce a more equitable result and would not be inconsistent with the purposes of this subchapter. And if such a contract has been performed, a court may not deny rescission at the instance of any party unless such court finds that under the circumstances, the denial of rescission would produce a more equitable result than its grant and would not be inconsistent with the purposes of this subchapter. The question is whether the phrase rescission at the instance of any party implies that private parties may sue. It does not. Section 47B is a mandate directed to courts, rather than a provision that confers a right on a specified class of persons. Sandoval holds that provision, phrased as a directive to federal agencies, does not create a private right or remedy. The key actor is a court, not an individual. And a court is told that it may not deny the remedy of rescission to parties who request it for performed contracts unless the equities and statutory purposes favor a different result. Section 47B's wording thus presupposes that parties are already before the court and directs the court's use of its remedial authority. It says not a word about individual rights. It bears emphasis that contract law treats rescission as a remedy, not a cause of action. Suits seeking rescission end up before courts in various ways. A party to a contract may bring an action under state law, say, for breach of contract, and ask the court to undo the contract. Or she may seek rescission when raising an affirmative defense, such as fraud, mistake, or duress in a breach of contract suit. Or a non-party, such as a shareholder, may seek rescission alleging that corporate officers violated their fiduciary duties. Regardless, other sources of law typically supply the right of action in suits requesting rescission. Section 47B's function underscores the provision's focus on a court's remedial power. The common law makes it difficult to obtain rescission if a contract has been performed. If a contract formed in violation of a statute has been fully executed on the part of the plaintiff, then neither a court of law nor a court of equity will assist the plaintiff to recover back the property conveyed or money paid under the contract. In that circumstance, the common law denies rescission and leaves the parties where their own acts have placed them. Section 47B deviates from that common law rule by instructing that courts may not deny rescission on the basis that a contract has been performed. By overriding the common law default, it unlocks remedies that would otherwise be unavailable. It does not create a cause of action. Statutory structure points in the same direction. As the principal dissent concedes, here and after the dissent, the Securities and Exchange Commission bears primary responsibility for ensuring compliance with the ICA. It may investigate and bring enforcement actions in response to violations of any provision of the ICA or of any rule, regulation, or order issued under the Act. It may also bring an action in court for injunctive relief or civil monetary penalties. Congress's decision to create a comprehensive agency enforcement scheme supports the conclusion that private parties generally cannot enforce the ICA. Put differently, the express provision of one method of enforcement suggests that Congress intended to preclude others. See Gonzaga University reasoning that because the Secretary of Education is authorized to enforce the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974, it does not create privately enforceable rights. While the Securities and Exchange Commission is the ICA's main enforcer, the Act also expressly authorizes two private rights of action. Since 1970, the ICA has allowed security holders to sue investment advisors for breaches of fiduciary duty. An action may be brought by a security holder of a registered investment company on behalf of such company for breach of fiduciary duty against certain members of the company. This provision also details how the right of action should operate. It assigns burdens of proof, caps damages, and specifies a forum. The ICA also incorporates an express right of action from the Securities Exchange Act, which allows an issuer of securities to recover certain short-term profits realized by a regulated individual. These provisions demonstrate that when Congress wished to provide a private remedy to enforce the ICA, it knew how to do so and did so expressly. We have traditionally been reluctant to conclude that Congress implicitly created a private remedy in one provision when it explicitly did so in another. See Transamerica Mortgage Advisors, Tama v. Lewis, 1979, reasoning that because one provision of the ICA authorizes private lawsuits for damages, we should not imply a private right of action for that relief elsewhere. So too here. In sum, nothing in the text or structure of the ICA indicates that Congress authorized private parties to enforce virtually every provision in the statute. For a cause of action to exist, we would have to create it. And having sworn off the habit of implying private rights of action, we will not accept Sava's invitation to have one last drink. Sava's counterarguments, while not without force, are ultimately unpersuasive. As for text, it points out that Section 47B also includes the phrase, at the instance of any party. According to Sava, this language displays Congress's intent to create a private right of action. But the ordinary meaning of, at the instance of a person, is at the solicitation or suggestion of. An instance, when used as verb, means to urge. The legal meaning of instance is the same. See, for example, Black's Law Dictionary, 12th edition, 2024, defining as urgent solicitation or insistence. So the phrase, a court may not deny rescission at the instance of any party, is most naturally read to direct a court's remedial power when a party before it is urging rescission. It says nothing about conferring a right to sue in the first place. Sava puts most of its chips on Tama, which holds that Section 2.5 of a different statute, the Investment Advisors Act, IAA, creates an implied right of action. Section 2.15 provides that contracts whose formation or performance violates the IAA shall be void. Tama reasons that by declaring certain contracts void, Section 2.15, by its terms necessarily contemplates that the issue of voidness under its criteria may be litigated somewhere. According to Tama, someone with the power to void a contract ordinarily may resort to a court to have the contract rescinded and to obtain restitution of consideration paid. See, Congress's use of void indicates that customary legal incidents of voidness would follow, including the availability of a suit. Thus, Tama holds that Section 215 of the IAA contains an implied private right of action to void an investment advisor's contract. As originally enacted, Section 47B of the ICA mirrored Section 215 of the IAA. Every contract made or performed in violation of the ICA shall be void. So under Tama, Sava says, Section 47B likewise contains a cause of action. Case closed. If this were 1979, the year that Tama was decided, then Sava would have a point. But as even the dissent grudgingly admits, something important happened in 1980. Congress amended the ICA and entirely reworked Section 47B. Relevant here, it added references to the key actor, a court. And Congress deleted the language that contracts formed in violation of the ICA shall be void and replaced it with two distinct phrases. The first states that contracts violating the ICA are unenforceable by either party, and the second provides that if one of those contracts has been performed, a court may not deny rescission. Sava tries to use the amendment to its advantage. It argues that Congress simply made the right of action. Tama recognizes explicit by inserting the term rescission. In other words, the edit was clarifying rather than substantive. But changed language typically indicates changed meaning, and the changes here are significant. Most importantly, Congress deleted the shall be void language on which Tama's reasoning turns and shifted the focus to regulating a court's remedial authority. Congress made these changes despite retaining the phrase shall be void in the immediately preceding provision. Likewise, it did not remove the shall be void language in the IAA, even though it made other changes to that statute. So what Sava portrays as a clarifying edit actually distinguishes Section 47B of the ICA from Section 215 of the IAA. The 1980 amendments were a renovation, not a new coat of paint. Given the textual differences between Section 47B and Section 215, Tama does not get Sava far. And to be clear, Sava would take Tama far indeed. Tama blesses only a limited private remedy to void an investment advisor's contract. Sava finds something much larger hiding in congressional silence. It would wield Section 47B to void any type of contract that violates the ICA. Tama is thin support for such a sweeping right. In the dissent's view, the key to this case lies in two committee reports expressing Congress's wish that courts liberally imply private rights of action. The dissent repeatedly faults us for failing to consider these reports and broadly attempts to defend the use of legislative history in interpreting statutes. Its efforts do not just fail, they backfire. Notably, the dissent does not use the committee reports to clarify the meaning of Section 47B. For instance, the dissent does not consult the committee reports to see how their authors use the words on which this case turns, rescission at the instance of any party. Nor does it try to identify the circumstances that prompted Congress to retool Section 47B. Instead, the dissent uses the reports on a mission impossible, divining how Congress would have wanted courts to resolve the question presented in this case. Its theory depends on the fictional premise that hundreds of legislators, not to mention the president, shared a unified private view of how the statute should apply in a contested circumstance. Worse, it violates the fundamental precept that we are governed by laws, not by the intentions of legislators. Even assuming that Congress's subjective intent were knowable and controlling, the dissent fails to deliver. Far from demonstrating the value of legislative history, the dissent models its misuse. The classic criticism of using legislative history is that it is the equivalent of entering a crowded cocktail party and looking over the heads of the guests for one's friends. True to form, the dissent navigates around unwelcome guests. The most relevant portions of the reports are those addressing Section 47B, which is, after all, the provision we are interpreting. But the dissent ignores these sections altogether, presumably because they undercut its argument. In its discussion of Section 47B, the House report nowhere mentions a private right of action. Instead, it states that the 1980 amendment embodies a general revision and is designed to provide clearer statutory guidance in interpreting that equitable rescission remedy. Rather than treating the amended provision as a right of action, both sections confirm the obvious point that rescission is a remedy. And their references to clearer statutory guidance in interpreting Section 47B support treating the provision as a directive to courts, the typical interpreters of statutes, about how to handle cases already before them. While ignoring these sections, the dissent takes creative license with others. It confidently assures the reader that there is legislative history containing an explicit statement from Congress imploring courts to imply private rights of action under the amended Section 47B. There is no such statement. The paragraph that the dissent cites in the Senate report speaks of implying causes of action in the federal securities laws generally, not the ICA specifically. The cited House report pages are similar. In fairness to the dissent, these paragraphs reference the ICA in passing, but not Section 47B. The Senate report says that courts should imply causes of action to the same extent that such causes of action are implied under the Investment Company Act. And the House report expresses the committee's expectation that in appropriate instances, for example, breaches of fiduciary duty involving personal misconduct should be remedied under Section 36A of the ICA. These committee reports do not, as the dissent claims, unequivocally express Congress's desire that courts imply causes of action under Section 47B of the ICA. At most, the dissent citations show that members of the House and Senate committees wanted courts to imply causes of action in some unidentified provisions of the securities laws. But even if committee members would have put Section 47B on that list, what should we make of it? The House report notes disapprovingly that in recent years, the Supreme Court has turned its focus toward a strict construction of statutory language and expressed intent. It then bemoans the court's unwillingness to imply causes of action and criticizes the court for declining to imply a damages remedy in TAMA. One wonders, if the House committee wanted to authorize private remedies and knew that the court would be reluctant to imply them, why did it not make them express? Were members of the House committee uncertain whether express causes of action would win approval from a majority of the House, a majority of the Senate, and the president? Did they worry that authorizing private remedies might undo compromises that enabled the bill to cross the finish line? There is no way to know. Congress expresses itself as a body through the text it enacts. the views of the 42-member House Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce and of the 15-member Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs are not the law. At bottom, the dissent hopes to revive that old-time devotion to legislative history. Instead of winning converts, however, the dissent illustrates why statutory interpretation must focus on the text, or, to borrow from Justice Robert Jackson, why interpretation must be driven by analysis of the statute rather than psychoanalysis of Congress. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered.